Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello, and welcome. Welcome to an hour of Mind Power. But we're going to take another step today. How many of you, if you're like me, have encountered situations in life and you say, I wish I had someone that could give me advice, someone that could tell me what to do? We all go through that. And this is something that's not that easy to come by. Have you ever found yourself wondering, how in the world can you determine who you should be talking to, what questions you should ask? Well, my guest today has put together a book with a different paradigm on this. His name is Raul Valdez Perez, and his book is called Advice is for Winners, How to Get Advice for Better Decisions in Life and Work. Raul, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Now, you're a man that is very much involved in business. You, in 2007, were made the Ernst & Young Entrepreneur of the Year. You have been on a computer science faculty at Carnegie Mellon University. You did a PhD under the Nobel laureate Herbert A. Simon. You have been involved in so many aspects of business, practical application, as well as working with the unknown. What prompted you to take the time? You said it took you 3 years to put the material for this book together. The people would say, well, getting a book on how to get advice, that all you do is do one sheet and that's it. Ask questions, talk to somebody you know, and that's the whole thing. But you found in your own personal experience that that wasn't the case. Why take on a project like this?
Well, there are a number of different reasons. The oldest historical reason is something that happened to me when I was in college, where, actually my book starts out on page one telling the story of a very wrong decision that a classmate of mine took by himself, where he didn't ask anyone for advice. I mean, it was not a life-threatening decision, but it just stunned me how he could make such a wrong decision in isolation. That story stuck with me for a long time. Now, I started a business in 2000 with two co-founders. It was a technology company, and I had been an academic most of my life, and we started the company, and none of us knew anything about business. So we were a small company that also didn't have a lot of money. And in such cases, we have three people who don't know anything about business and don't have much money. You don't have a deep bench strength. So in order to make good decisions, we really had to develop the habit to reach out informally to people, to explain what decisions we had to make, and get good-natured advice, get informal advice from others. So I made that a habit. It worked out well. The company grew over 12 years, and last May, was bought by IBM, finally.
Mm-hmm.
So there are various influences, having lived through it, and also stories that I encountered in my youth.
Now, what I found very interesting, and I could relate to a lot of scenarios in the book that you have, dependent on how a person is raised many times, the cultural environment they're in, they don't reach out for help. I know when I was growing up, that was something, just suck it up, kid, figure it out on your own, don't bother people, you've got to stand on your own 2 feet. Don't ask questions. Don't rock the boat. And, boy, that got me into a lot of trouble many times. And I found myself, and I'm using me as an example because it's the best one I know, I found many times I ended up adopting attitudes of failure because I had not opened up to people, letting them know I needed help, basically. That's how I will term it. And I honestly didn't even know the right questions to ask. So you address this in your book, and going back full circle to what you said about your friend, who didn't bother to ask questions. Now, you had a predisposition towards doing this, and one of the comments in your book is, human beings have a prodigious capacity to learn from peers. Well, that can be a plus or a minus, depending on what side of the fence you're on, but face-to-face dialogue and interaction with people, in our world today, a lot of that has disappeared. People just are saying, I'm either too busy, they're letting technology take over, and by golly, none of us are in this world by ourselves. We're all interdependent on one level or another. And I think your book is a very, very good one. And you bring up points about how to think about getting advice, decide if seeking it is worthwhile, figure out who are good advisors. And I want to touch on some of these. Do background research, approach the advisors productively, engage with them in human terms, evaluate their counsel, choose the best courses of action with more confidence, not agonize every step of the way. Let's take one that I think is very important. Figuring out who are good advisors. Holy Moses, I think all of us have encountered people that have lied, cheated, stolen from us, and just misrepresented everything. And we go, oh, why did I ever ask that person for advice? How can we determine who is a good advisor for us?
Well, that is, as you said, it's one chapter in my book, The Qualities of a Good Advisor, and obviously you want a lot of commonsensical qualities. You want somebody who cares about you and who's honest and all those things. But I think there's one overriding quality of a good advisor that follows from a principle that I try to lay out in the book. So let me mention the principle first, and then what quality of a good advisor follows from that principle.
Okay.
So the principle is that good advice must take account of your circumstances, your goals, and your constraints. Otherwise, it's not advice. It's a principle, or it's a story, or it's an anecdote, and those are great things, but if it doesn't talk about you, then it's not advice. So, for example, I often read articles in magazines that say, or I've been asked on interviews, you know, what's the advice that you would give to readers? And I say, I can't give advice to readers, because I don't know anything about them.
Mm-hmm.
I can state some principles, and principles are great, but I can't give advice to readers because advice depends on their situation. Okay, so if you believe this principle, then what quality of a good advisor follows from that? Well, the advisor must be in a position, before giving advice, to understand your circumstances, goals, and constraints. And how do they do that? By listening. So the number one quality of a good advisor is someone who is a good listener, who will listen to you before throwing out advice. Not everybody's a good listener. Some people have a lot of subject matter knowledge, and they're not good listeners. And in my book, I say, well, don't reject those people, but coach them.
Mm-hmm.
Make sure that, advising is a collaborative process. It's not just a one-way process. For it to succeed, it takes two to tango. So in that case, you make sure that you explain to them what your situation is and get that in before they start talking. So I would say that's the number one quality of a good advisor, being a good listener.
All right, that is something. And what I liked in your book is that you show both sides of the coin. Someone to be a good advisor is they do absolutely have to listen. I think anybody that is involved in the counseling business, anyone that is involved with social interaction with people, you have to keep your mouth shut and listen to what's going on with them. And really, really listen. Because sometimes all they want to do is talk. There are sometimes people will finish, I've had this experience as a counselor. By the time they finish talking with me, they'll give themselves their own answer because they have had a safe place where they have been able to communicate. Other times, they need to be shown different options. What is it they should consider? Why is it this is something that's good? Why is it that something is not so good? The process of learning how to think is a process. It's something we can learn. And that's something that you reinforce in your book, and I think this is invaluable. And you make a comment of matching the advisor qualities to one's needs. You're not going to talk to someone who bakes the top-notch cinnamon rolls when you are wanting to know something about heart problems. That isn't what you're going to do. Now, I know that's sort of a silly example. Let's address that for a bit, because the needs of someone, what they really want, if someone's wanting to know about manufacturing, you're not going to go talk to someone in a pet store. So how can we evaluate that better?
Well, I think it helps to figure out what one needs are. So I think that the chapter 2 of the book first talks about what are really the benefits of advice. Some people think that advice is, okay, what's the solution to my problem? That's a very narrow point of view of advice and leads to making mistakes. For example, when people offer help but they don't have a ready solution to your problem, you kind of ignore them because you're looking for a solution. It's a mistake. So advice consists of solutions. It consists of introductions to other people, of things that you should read, of events that you should attend. It consists of questions that you should ask yourself that maybe haven't occurred to you. It consists of confidence that you're not overlooking something so you can proceed vigorously, et cetera. Let me give you one example. A friend told me when she bought a house in her early days, soon after she was married. You know, buying houses is something that is not new in the history of humanity, right? Lots of people have bought houses before.
True.
So one would think that in order to buy a house and to do it well, gee, you might pay to take somebody for a coffee or invite them to dinner and ask them about their house buying experience. What did they miss? What regrets did they have? Now, my friend didn't do that, and she didn't ask herself a question that somebody older could have pointed out to her, which was, gee, when I have children, do I still want to live in this house? And it turned out that the answer is no, and that they were going to have children pretty soon, but they never asked themselves that question. So mm-hmm. they bought a house, they enjoyed living there for a year, and then they had to move out because it never occurred to them to ask themselves that question. So advice consists of many things, not just one thing. Your question was... I'm sorry, what was...
No, go ahead.
I started
ahead.
Going
I'm
on
sorry.
That path, and I forgot the question that you posed.
Okay, finding the right advisor for what it is that you have.
Right,
and
right.
I also want you to address the principles for approaching people who you would like to have as an advisor. You find someone that you really like. How do you approach them? What are the points of etiquette, if you will?
So I think I can address both questions. It helps if you think what you need. So maybe what you need is, okay, I'm looking for a solution to my problem. I'm not even sure what a good solution looks like. You know, what are the qualities a good solution should look like? So if you can think of those things that you need, then you can approach an advisor and tell them specifically, I have this problem. I think you have experience that's relevant to you, to me, and I'm trying to achieve this. And I'd like to pick your brain about this topic. For example, I'd like to pick your brain on what questions I should be asking myself as I consider solutions. The problem is, and I've seen this many times, is one is approached for advice in a very casual way, especially, let's say, from strangers. I mean, I respond to strangers mm-hmm. if they approach me well. Here's a bad approach. You know, I get a LinkedIn invitation or an email saying, gee, I'd like to network with you. You know, what's your schedule look like? Not a mm-hmm. good approach. Here's a good approach. I know what your background is, and I know that you have experience with the following area. I am trying to achieve something in my life or whatever, and I have this particular problem, and I'd like to pick your brain about this specific problem. Could I meet with you at your convenience?
Mm-hmm.
If that is done well, I mean, advice seeking is not just an intellectual task where you match, you know, your knowledge to other people's knowledge to your problems. It's also a social task, so it has to be done well. So if you are the advice seeker, you have to approach people with deference, explain to them why they could be a good advisor, why could they give you good advice, and what exactly do you need from them. Those are all, I think, tactful things to do, and they're part of what makes up doing the task well.
one of the tools, the electronic tools that you recommend of social networking is LinkedIn. How can someone utilize LinkedIn? And I know there are millions of people that are involved with this, but this is primarily a professional network. How would you recommend someone utilize this?
Well, I would use it professionally. I use it all the time. I use it in the following way. I want to know about a subject, and I search for, I live in Pittsburgh, so I search for people, for example, who live in the Pittsburgh area who mention a certain topic. So presumably they know something about it. And maybe I'm trying to learn something about it for either business purpose or maybe some other purpose. And then I find someone, and let's say that we know some people in common. And then, you know, I will either ask for introduction or I'll write to the person directly. If it's a business context, I'll write to them and say that I see that you have experience in this area. I'm trying to achieve the following. And could I come by at your convenience, maybe take you to lunch, explain what, you know, what I'm looking for, what my issue is, and pick your brain. And you do it at their convenience. You go and visit them, and you take them to lunch. And in general, I think if approached the right way, very many people are happy to do this because they enlarge their own acquaintance of people. They learn more about interesting problems, and many people will say yes to this. Not everybody, but you know, the cost is maybe one email or LinkedIn message that doesn't take very long. I find this very fruitful.
When you put this book together, you also talk about various avenues where we can read materials. There's various programs we can watch. But there is something about conversation with another human being, someone that has walked a walk of their own, that is extremely powerful. And I think those alliances of respect and mutual appreciation go a long way to making one's life much richer. I know I've treasured the associations that I've had with certain individuals through the years because of their honesty, their integrity. They really are sincere about wanting to see me achieve. I've also encountered the others that really don't care and do everything they can to serve their own agendas, and I know everyone listening to this show this morning will say the same thing. Oh, boy, I could tell you a story or two. Now, you yourself have gone through a lot of shifts and changes, and you had a particular challenge that I'd like you to share with my audience, because you were the CEO of Vivissimo, a company, and you really were involved with the software business. And there was a need to get increased revenue. We're not talking about $500 here. We're talking about a very large sum of money. You had to ask some questions of yourself, and you went around trying to brainstorm with other people. Tell us how you managed to figure out the right decision for yourself with this without getting scalped.
Well, the story you're referring to is about 7 years after founding. We had developed a full product rather than a partial product for the marketplace, and we were starting to compete for large so-called enterprise contracts, business contracts, and winning mm-hmm. on the strength of our product and our people. And so we saw a large market where we had the right product and where we were winning, and that's a very good time to then start looking for capital to grow faster. So I wanted to go out and raise professional investment capital. I had never done that before. So at that stage, I was about 50 years old, actually. I had raised money from the government for science research as an academic. So I knew how to do that, but I had never raised money from professional investors. So I identified three CEOs here in my area in Pittsburgh, and I wrote to them and saying, look, I'm looking to raise capital. I've never done this before. I know you've done this a number of times. Can I come by, explain our situation, and pick your brain over lunch on what's the right path to take? And all three of them said, sure. I mean, people have lunch every day anyway. It's not like mm-hmm. you're asking them to do something unusual. mm-hmm. And very often people like to share their knowledge. So I met with the three of them. I explained the situation. I got three contradictory pieces of advice, which did not unnerve me because I'm very much used to contradiction. You know, in academic circles, people think that, for example, in science is certain knowledge. Everybody agrees with everybody else. But actually, everybody disagrees with everybody else. So I'm very comfortable with contradiction. So I had to decide which of the three made most sense. You know, I asked myself a number of questions. Do these three recommenders, are they possibly recommending one course of option because that's the only one that they have experience with themselves? You know, do the reasons make sense? Some of the things that one would say I would pose to the other to see what they thought, et cetera. And then I was able to pick one course of option that I thought was the best one, given those three. And it turned out well. Actually, we raised the money, and that furthered our growth. So that was a very very good experience.
One of the points that you bring out, which I think is very significant, is researching the background of people that are going to be advisors. Now, some people listening today say, oh my goodness, it sounds like I have to act like a private detective. Researching background, and I can remember incidences where I didn't do that. I just liked someone, I trusted them, and I just said, oh, this is going to be great, and I ended up in the proverbial hole. And I just said, how in the world did I get here? And when I really analyzed it carefully, I found that I had been working from a positioning of fear, number one. And number two, I really hadn't done my homework on the background of these various individuals. Let's cover that, because so many times we have people that could talk the bark off of the tree, but they are totally unethical, and you don't want to have any association with them. How do you research the background of someone?
Well, I should confess that in my own background, I don't really come across unethical people very much. I've not had that problem. But I do advocate researching the background because, again, seeking advice from others is a social process. So you have to take account of the feelings of the other person. If you are approached for advice by someone who knows very little about you, that doesn't make you feel very good, does it?
Mm-hmm.
They haven't done their homework. I've been approached for advice sometimes. I remember one time someone who I liked very much asked me to speak with the CEO of a company that he was investing in, and because he thought I had relevant knowledge. And I said, sure, I'll talk with him. So we set up a one-hour meeting. I got the phone call from this individual who was not a 20-year-old, must have been a 45-year-old. And after 1 or 2 minutes of conversation, I quickly realized that he knew very little about me. He had not taken 5 minutes to look a little bit about my background on the web to understand why this friend had suggested that I speak with him. That doesn't make me feel good, does it?
Mm-hmm.
The person hasn't done his homework. So researching people's backgrounds on the web partly is to figure out, you know, who are the right people to talk to, but also to show them that you've done your homework and you've prepared for the call or prepared for the meeting. And that makes people feel good. And you want people to feel good if you're going to seek advice from them or create a social engagement that could last longer than this particular meeting.
There are so many excellent points that you bring out in your book that I'm just pulling out a few, but you really emphasize if you want to get a response from someone, don't send them the same thing you send to 2,000 other people. If you really want to have that personal touch, I firmly believe in the phone myself. I'm very much fond of the electronic media. But I'll tell you, I find that one-on-one, that communication, just a few minutes, you don't have to occupy somebody's time a great deal, but calling personally really does add something very special. Do you find that this is the case? Do you appreciate that even more than, let's say, something sent to you electronically?
Absolutely. I think, number one, the personal touch helps, whether it's face-to-face, going out of your way to visit face-to-face, picking up the phone, making a phone call, writing a letter. So that shows effort on your part. So people generally have an effort filter. If the effort that this person is undergoing is not much, then I'm not going to pay attention to me. It's almost like romancing, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you're being romanced by someone and you know, what do they do? Gee, I'd like to go out on a date with you. Here's an email. How do you respond to that?
That would be as exciting as a dried turnip.
But if they take the effort and you feel that, gee, you know, it's you that they're interested in, because there's something in your knowledge and experience that they really would value, then that's flattering, and people like to feel good. It's such a human process. So you're right. I actually use email a lot myself, but I spend quite a bit of time composing the email. I make sure it looks good, that it's personalized to the recipient. So that personal touch is very important.
It really is very, very important. And I do think that the positioning that your book takes is such a good one. It encourages one to look at how they can shift their perception of what they think is possible and what they can do. Now, you use a formula from an individual, Selikus. You say these are questions that should be asked. And I thought, you know what? They actually are pretty good questions that one should ask themselves occasionally in everyday life. Where have I been? Where am I now? Where do I want to go? What do you think? What advice would you give me? What would you do in my situation? What could be bad choices? That is a very important question. What is the worst case scenario that could possibly occur here? Very few people ever want to present that question. What could go wrong? Have you ever encountered a similar situation? If someone hasn't encountered something similar, that could be the contradictory situation where they may give an opinion, but they really don't have any what I'd call real-life experience. And you say make sure you bring a piece of paper and a pen with you or a little notebook so you can make notes. This is good.
Yeah, making notes, it's part of showing the person, the advisor, the person you're asking for advice, that you care about what they're saying, and this encounter is valuable. You touched on a very important point just a minute ago. Earlier I spoke about how a good advisor is a good listener, and they have to listen to you first. Okay, fine, so you talk, but what do you say? I think the structure that I actually picked up from another book that I read, that book was written in order to teach people how to be good advisors. I think that structure is the right one, and you, as a skillful advice seeker, should follow that structure, because not everybody who you could get advice from is going to be a very skillful advisor. So it's up to you mm-hmm. to do it right. And that is, lay it out the way you just mentioned, explain where am I now, how did I get there, where do I want to go, and how you, the advisor, could help me. I mean, that's the perfect structure.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, it's all, you know, kind of fuzzy.
Well, and I agree. And what it does, because people that you want to have time with, they're busy usually, unless they're in their 90s and they're just really not that active. But I know people that are in their 90s that are just incredibly active. And I just think it's a matter of respect when you can lay things out in as clear a picture as you possibly can. Most people I find, if you say, I honestly don't know about this, do you? They will respond. They may say, I'm sorry, I just am not the right person for you to talk to. I honestly don't know. And there's nothing wrong with that. You can be very gracious and say, gee, thank you so much. There are others, they'll say, sit down. Do you have an hour and a half? Let me tell you what I went through. And you need to honor and respect all of that, because it's very important. Not everybody's going to walk the same path, the same direction, and wear the same kind of costume. So it really is interesting what you have put together in your book. And I know that you have a website, adviceisforwinners.com. And for those of you listening, Raul Valdez Perez is a man that has taken a positioning that would empower you as an individual to know how to get information more effectively, efficiently, and encourages you to think about your application. And it gives you a sense of empowerment that so many times we just don't think we have. Don't know how to ask the right questions? He has some very good ones in here that can be the lead questions for you to utilize with that person that maybe you want to learn from. It's a fascinating book, and it's a very useful book. And I'd encourage those of you that may want to get the copy of the book, have a highlighter with you. Highlight certain aspects. Use it. Maybe just do one chapter at a time. I think you'll find it a very good tool. Raul Valdez Perez, thank you so much for being my guest. Your website advice is forwinners.com. People can go there. I appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule to be with me today.
Oh, thanks. It's been my pleasure.
This is Donna Sebo. We're going to take a break. Don't forget, check out adviceisforwinners.com. We'll be right back.
Do you have children between the ages of 3 to 10? Do you love children's books and collect them? Then you'll want to know about God's Kiss, the award-winning illustrated children's book that has been enjoyed by families around the world. 15 beautiful illustrations by Pacific Northwest artist Ed Gedros accompany this lovely story about a little boy named Johnny that will capture your heart and mind in a very special way. Multicultural and non-denominational in content, it will become a family favorite that you and your children will want to read again and again. This book is available by itself through Amazon, or if you contact me, Donna Sebo, directly, you can get a personalized signed copy. There is also a talking book. You can order the talking book CD by contacting me via email, donna@delphiinternational.com, or by calling 253-582-5604. You can also visit my website, delphiinternational.com, to see more details. God's Kiss is a family classic that belongs in everyone's library. Get your copy now.
Hi, this is Donna. Telephone lines are now open, 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. My goodness, life is full of so many opportunities. And for those of you that are listening to me for the first time, just know that when you call into the show, all I need from you is your first name or your initial, and then I'm happy to share with you my mental skills, giving you insights into what's going on in your life. And after that, you are welcome to ask me a question about anything that you like. What do we have lined up for next week? Well, we've got Bob Wright. His book is Rugged Mercy. This is a fascinating, true documentary story, if you will, about an old-time country doctor. And this takes place in the area of Montana. It is wonderful. It gives just so much insights into the past and what people had to do then. I was going to have Beverly Flaxton on Tuesday, but she's had to cancel because of a travel show, so we have got, an open mic day on Tuesday of next week, so you'll be able to call in at any time during the hour on Tuesday. Run Your Own Corporation, Garrett Sutton. Do you want to have a corporation of your own? What size should it be? Do you really want to do it? What does it take to run a corporation? Can you do it as a person of one, or are you going to have, maybe 100, 2,000 people under you? Well, we'll find out about that. Ready for Pre-Tirement, Chris Miller. This is something that those of you that are younger, the whole picture of how to prepare for your older years has changed. What if you're in your middle age years? But the way things are going on in the economy, you wonder, what can I do? Is it worth it? Is there any safe place? And if you are in your 60s, your likelihood of your living to be close to 100, if not over 100, well, that's pretty high in today's world. So what age? Doesn't make any difference. How can you plan? We'll be discussing that with Chris. And Milt Larson is going to be my guest a week from today, My Magical Journey. If you love magic, you're going to love this guy because his history is magical. And he is the founder of the Magic Castle that is world-renowned in Los Angeles. So we're going to have a chance to chat with him. What a fascinating man. It's just, we got such a unique and dynamic week. So tell your friends about the show and join me next week. I would be delighted to have you. Give me a call. Phone lines are open at 888-627-6008. Oh, technology, the inventiveness of the human being. We can come up with things that just sci-fi, yes, but eventually it becomes the real thing. If you're like me and you had the opportunity to watch The Jetsons, oh, my goodness, that family, you had Rosie the robot that did all the house cleaning. I could take a couple of those, thank you very much. But I really liked their self-cleaning house myself. I thought that was really pretty cool. Well, guess what? They are actually working today on a bed that makes itself. Yes, teenagers of the world and adults that hate making up beds, this is something that is evolving, and it's due to a Spanish furniture company, Ohia, and they are going to be bringing us out really interesting. Excuse me, it's called a smart bed. Now, this is a lot like the average bed. However, this is what makes it different. You'll tap a remote. Mechanical arms are going to straighten out sheets and pillows in less than a minute. To keep you safe as you sleep, a mechanism prevents the magical mattress from making itself while you're still in dreamland. That would be a little bit unsettling, having a short in the mechanical apparatus where your bed is made up while you're in it. No, we don't want that. But anyway, that's being worked on, folks. Absolutely amazing. Also, the 3D experiences that we have been enjoying, there was a time when they came out with 3D that didn't go anywhere. Today, it has really become different because of the advancement of technology. Now, Frank Sinatra and Tupac Shakur were inspired by a director, Martin Sorkin, to claim if everything moves along and there's no major catastrophe, we're headed towards hologram. That's right. There was a 3D experience that actors would walk through the audience transforming a theater into a live movie set. Well, we are well on the way with that. And, of course, we've been well prepared, haven't we, through Star Trek, and through Star Wars, and through various things that have been shown in the sci-fi imagination concept for a lot of years. Now, hospitals, how are things changing? Well, there's a team at Harvard University that's created a liquid coating that is so slippery that bacteria slide right off of it. Why did they try to invent this? Why are they even interested in doing this? Well, they say germs can't make you sick if they don't stick. So they want to cover catheters and other hospital equipment with this material because they believe it would reduce the risk of infection. And let's go into transportation, and let's talk about that for a minute. Have you ever seen the old Disney program where there was the vision of the future of smart roads? Now, that's sort of a modern terminology. Well, there's a Dutch designer, Dan Rosgaard, says we could use a dynamic paint that signals road conditions by responding to temperature fluctuations. When a surface is cold and slippery, drivers will see glowing images of ice crystals and a solar-charged photoluminescent lime paint that glows in the dark at night. Now, that's one of the smart road ideas. But also, how about having something with a magnetic strip? Disney was thinking about that a long time ago. Disney, in fact, used the monorail. So we're finally catching up with the forward thinking of people many, many, many years later. And we're going to be, I think, experiencing some very unique applications that are going to change our lives dramatically. But as with all things, takes a little bit of time. It doesn't happen real fast. Donna Sebo here. Give me a buzz if you would like to chat, 888-627-6008. And for those of you listening up in the far north, in Alaska, I will be going up to Alaska, and I'm very close to putting the dates on my appearances there. Down, we're getting getting them all scheduled, and by next week I should be able to let you know where I'm going to be. I know I'll be in Fairbanks and in Anchorage, but I'll give you all the details at a later time. Donna Siebel here. Give me a buzz at 888-627-6008 if you would like for me to light up your life with a little bit of insight. The Japanese are known for typically having environments that are not filled with clutter. And I really respect and appreciate the simplistic style often that they use. And it just, it's very soothing. When you walk into a typical Japanese garden, there's beautiful arrangements, but there's a lot of space in between the arrangements. And that is a very relaxing environment. And they're known for their exquisite flower arrangements, where less is just exquisitely displayed. Well, here are some tips. They seem to like the rule of three. I came across some information by a James Novak, and he has a site called bitesizeliving.com, and he said they like to put out three items. They figure you can rotate them, but three items at a time, and then just change them every few months if you want. And that way you have this sense of openness. And they have an attitude, and I really believe in this, straighten up one area at a time. And I've found that this has worked for me very, very well. If you're like me and you're busy and you have a lot going on, before you know it, things have been put in different places and you go, uh-oh, time to pick stuff up. Well, I find if I can put something away when I'm thinking of it at that moment, the clutter usually doesn't evolve. But if I get interrupted, sidetracked, whether it's paperwork or something else, then all of a sudden, here comes the clutter. So being able to do just one space at a time, putting that in order, and then moving on to another really does work well. And I like to use a timer. They didn't, you know, Jamie didn't say anything about that, but I like to use a timer sometimes so that I know, and I do this even when I'm on the computer. I'll set a timer. When that timer goes off, I know it's time for me to shift. I know I need to do something else. I know I need to move on. So just think of those little tips. They can help you. Also, getting rid of things that you don't need anymore. The Japanese call it muda, M-U-D-A. Pick up an item, ask yourself, do I need this? Is this something that brings me joy when I look at it? Do I really need it? If the answer is no, put it away in a box for a month. If you miss it, fine, it'll still be there. But if you don't want it anymore, donate it to a charity or give it away. There's a website called freecycle.com, and they'll take your stuff. So you want to be sure that you have in your environment those things that you do love. I was talking with someone just recently, just this past week, where a member of their family had become a hoarder. And they said this person had always been very meticulous, and now it's just absolutely chaos in their life. Well, when it gets to that point, that's demonstrating that there is something that has shifted in that person's thinking. If they've been very, very meticulous, there's something that's making them feel hopeless, something where they just really are detaching themselves from life, they're disassociating, and they just keep putting stuff, they just aren't taking care of things mentally, physically, emotionally, and spiritually. And we had a member of our family that that happened with. And when I reflect on that person, when they put themselves in a situation where they felt that they could no longer have any of their own power as an individual, that's what they did. They absolutely just totally stopped doing what was necessary, and they gave up on their own level of personal responsibility. And that is something that if you know of someone that is going through that kind of a patterning, if it's been that dramatic a shift, if you can, they may need some help. They may need to consult a mental counselor of some kind. But you need to know that that person is having some issues, psychological issues, emotional issues, and they just don't know how to deal with them themselves. They need some assistance. They need someone that can come in and can work with them. And then maybe they'll be able to get the balance in the life that they want. And I had to chuckle. One of the suggestions for decluttering was putting your house on a diet. What you need to do is, if you get an urge to buy something, take a picture of it, step back, ask yourself 24, 48 hours later, is this really something I need? You'll find you don't. You can make do many times with what you already have, and tuck that money aside. Put that in a savings account or invest it. This is Donna Sebo. We're going to take a break. When I come back, I have a real nice recipe for cream of asparagus soup that is absolutely yummy. Asparagus is out, and it's one of my favorite vegetables. But also, a story about someone that's making a difference in life in a very unusual way. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
As a counselor, Donna Sebo is available for private consultations by appointment. These can be done by telephone or in person. If you'd like to schedule an appointment with Donna, call 253-582-5604 or 800-872-8852. That's 253-582-5604.
Hi, this is Donna. I don't know about you, but with spring in our local markets, and we have this wonderful market in our neighborhood called H&L, and they have produce from our local farmers. It's just marvelous. And asparagus isn't quite ready to come out from our Northwest growers yet, but I found that asparagus was out. Oh, it's just fabulous. It's absolutely wonderful. And I found this recipe, and I said, now this is something that in spring, this is a very light meal, and with freshly baked bread, maybe a nice salad, or if you like me, you want to have a special day where you have your very special dessert. One of my favorites is cheesecake. But anyway, this is something that is light, and you can adapt it in any way that you want. But it's really, really easy, and it just gives you that little bit of warmth. You've got good nutrition in it, but it is light. It's not real heavy. And as we go from spring into summer, it seems like our food patterns, we want the lighter food. This is great for an evening meal. Now, this is what you're going to need. A tablespoon of butter, two shallots chopped, about a quarter of a cup. And you can use another onion if you like. The shallots are a very delicate flavor. They're not as strong as your yellow onion. But if you don't have shallots, don't worry about it. Cut up finely the regular onion. You need about a quarter of a cup. You're going to need about a pound of asparagus. You want to trim them. And when you're working with asparagus, it will bend. And I learned a trick from someone, and that is when you bend the asparagus gently, what will pop off in your hand is the part that you want to discard. You want to be able to make a broth with it, but you don't want to blend it in to the soup itself. So keep those little pieces that snap off, the tough parts, because they have a flavor all of their own. You're going to need to cut your asparagus, once you trim it, into 1/2-inch pieces. It'll come to about three cups of asparagus. You're going to need a potato. You want it about maybe a 1/2 pound, 7 ounces, 8 ounces of potato. You want to cut that into small pieces, about 1/2-inch in size. That's going to be about 1 1/4 cups of potato. And then you're going to need a can, about 14 ounces, 15 ounces of vegetable broth, tiny bit of salt, tiny bit of pepper, 2 tablespoons of chopped fresh parsley, fresh is best, and then you need a tablespoon of chopped fresh tarragon. Now, you can use dried if you want, but remember, the fresh has a different taste to it. It's got what I call a more delicate taste to it. And you're going to need a teaspoon of grated lemon zest. A cup of 1/2 and 1/2 goes for this as well. Now, you can actually make this soup in advance, adding your 1/2 and 1/2 later. You can just combine your ingredients. You're going to melt your butter over medium heat, add your shallots, your onions, cook them just until they're softened. You don't want them to brown. You want them to get soft. Then you add your asparagus, your potato, your broth, little tiny bit of salt and pepper. Bring it to a boil, reduce the heat to low. You cook it for 20 minutes. Until the asparagus is tender and the potatoes are tender, and you're going to let it cool after the 20 minutes of cooking. Then you're going to stir in your parsley, your tarragon, and your zest, and the next thing you're going to use is your handy-dandy blender. That's right. Because it's cooled a little bit, Then you add it in batches into your blender and puree it. It's very simple. It's just going to take you a minute or two. Then you return that to the pot. Now, if you wanted to make this the day ahead, let's say you're going to have company over the weekend, make it the day ahead, then you put this batch in the refrigerator. If you want it shortly for your own meal, you put it back in the pot, stir in your half and half, and over medium-low heat, you just stir it occasionally until it's heated through. It's going to take you about 5 minutes. Do you know? It's supposed to serve 6 people. You could make a meal off of this. You really could. It's only 120 calories a serving. So you can do this. If you say, gee, Donna, I don't want to use half and half, terrific. Then use 2% milk if you want. But you need to have some of the fat of the milk so that it's going to give this creamy texture. If you really wanted this to be rich, use regular cream. That's right. It will come out deliciously, wonderfully flavorful. And we have an attitude in our society. It's been going on for so long that fat is bad. It is not. Fat is very necessary. Women especially, if they deprive themselves of fats in their diet, they have problems with hormonal levels because you need the fat. The body utilizes the fat. So here's something that's light, not heavy in calorie, and it's something that is going to just taste good. And like I said, freshly baked bread and a nice salad to go with this. You could serve this with just about anything. Personally, I think if you have big mugs and you take it along, it's a great thing to take to a game. And you can have it in a thermos. It'll keep. It's just great. It's real simple, easy, and the flavor is delicious. It really is good. Donna Sebo here. Give me a buzz if you would like to chat. Telephone number to call into is 888-627-6008. Well, I have a story to share with you about a woman. Her name is Carol, and Carol's a dwarf. And we don't often hear stories about people who overcome obstacles and difficulties that they're sort of, well, not paid attention to. Now, she had obviously been born with dwarfism. She wanted to have a partner in her life. And one of her big questions in her life was, is there anyone in the world who will ever love me? She was a person that had a whole different type of experience. Now, she had been born into a family where everybody was of average size. Her parents, though, didn't treat her differently from the rest of the kids. She was not in any way considered limited. They just said, well, you're a little person. So what? You can do everything that anybody else does. She became all of 3 feet, 11 inches. She went to college, got an excellent job, had her own place, and she thought, well, the dream that so many people have, getting married, having a family, that's going to be my dream. Well, Carol never even had a boyfriend. That just wasn't in her life. She became quite concerned. She was going to end up spending her life alone. Now, one day, Carol hears about an organization, the Little People of America, LPA. But she had never wanted to really get involved with anything like that because she had lived in the world and she didn't see that she was different from anybody else. However, there came a point in her life, and this was in 2001, that she decided she was going to find out about this group. She met a wonderful couple there. They were going to have a baby. They were all dwarfs. And she said it was just an amazing experience. She really enjoyed them. Well, in 2005, the wife of this couple that she had met passed away. And she started getting in touch with the husband, who had children to raise, and was just beside himself. So they just developed a communication, a correspondence. Long and short of it was that in 2008, Carol and Mark were married. They were in their 40s, having children. Well, Carol said, it's too late for me. But they decided to adopt. And they adopted a little girl from China who was a dwarf. Now, in that culture, she would have been an outcast. It took 2 years, but they brought 4-year-old Leah home, and that made their family complete because Priya was also their little girl. She said, "We're not the traditional family, but this is the way God made our family, and we tell our girls all the time, be happy with who you are, because everyone is special." I wanted to share that with you. This is Donna Sebo. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. Your universe, just like what Carol found, your universe has a magic in it that nobody else is going to be able to experience but you. Be open to that magic. Be open to suggestions. Remember, like my guest today said, advice is for winners, and that's what you are. I look forward to being with you again on Monday. Tell your friends about the show. I'd love to have them join us. Let's share our knowledge. Enjoy a fabulous weekend. This is Donna. Talk to you on Monday. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.